My guest is Timothy Garton-Ash. Timothy Garton-Ash is Professor of European Studies at the University of Oxford, and his most recent book is Homelands, A Personal History of Europe, now published in 24 languages. Welcome to the podcast, Timothy.
Good to be with you again.
Right, you say again, yes, our last podcast chat was in February 2021, so it's time we had a follow-up chat, absolutely. So we're going to talk essentially in this podcast about the far right in Europe, but obviously also the impact of the recent US presidential elections a couple of days ago as we record this. But to get things straight at the very outset, Timothy, is there a kind of generic phrase we could use, or is it sloppy to assume that the words are interchangeable? Far right, extreme right, populist parties. What is the kind of phrase you're most comfortable with using?
So I would now say hard right,
Okay.
because far implies they're far out on a spectrum.
Right.
What we've seen in the last 5 years is that they're no longer far out on a spectrum. Giorgia Meloni, who comes from a post-neo-fascist party, to be strictly accurate, is the Prime Minister of Italy. And other, Marine Le Pen is, in a sense, the current French government is on sufferance from Marine Le Pen. So these parties are in extraordinary positions of influence in the mainstream.
Right, I use a slightly journalistic phrase, the rise of now, okay, the hard right, to use your phrase. That suggests a kind of inexorability, the rise. Will there be at some point a downward inflection, or are we entering a period of the dominance of these groupings around the European political system?
So, of course, nobody knows. But if you remember, a couple of years ago, there was a cheerful conversation about having reached peak populism.
Right.
And what's absolutely clear is that that's not the case. And I thought that at the time. And I think one reason for that, Paul, is that in Europe, as in the United States, what I call the aquifers of anger and resentment at the world, to put it simply, we liberals have built, are still overflowing,
Right.
right? So among our electorates, people who feel they've done very badly out of 30 or 40 years of globalized financialized capitalism, economically, who feel condescended to by metropolitan liberal elites, and who feel culturally that, quote unquote, I don't recognize my country anymore. That's still a mass social phenomenon in most of our countries.
Are you at all alarmed as you look around the European Union, the EU27? It seems that there are very few EU member states which do not have some quite strong presence now of hard right parties. It seems like a trend. They start as a fringe of a protest movement, then they become a small party and have representation in the national parliament. Then they become maybe a junior partner in a coalition government, and then they become the dominant member of a coalition government.
I mean, look, we could go around the continent, couldn't we? Law and Justice in Poland, Fratelli d'Italia, Rassemblement National, Vox, Reform Party in Britain. I mean, we could just go on and on. By the way, with one characteristic being that they often have social and economic policies more usually associated with the left,
Right.
a large role for the state and some distribution, together with cultural and foreign policies very much of the right. But yes, they clearly are up to now a growing element in the landscape. As we speak today, the European political community is meeting in Budapest,
Yep.
host Viktor Orban, who is in a way the flag bearer, the ideological flag bearer of this tendency. And a good, I don't know, 8 or 10 of those countries represented at that meeting, probably more, will have significant political forces from the hard right, some of them in power. And this, of course, also means they like Donald Trump.
But is it a case also that there are obviously these social tensions which create resentment and concern, and therefore citizens, voters turn to these new populist parties? But is there some kind of playbook, some kind of manual that these parties look to when they exchange best practice almost? They see what works in a neighboring country and try it on again, Or are these kind of organic expressions, organic growth based on the particular circumstances in each particular country?
No, look, I mean, there is obviously, I mean, people like to say that a nationalist international is a contradiction in terms, but there is something like a nationalist international, or if you want an anti-liberal internazionale, and they have connections, explicitly have connections. They speak at each other's rallies. They copy many of the same techniques. For example, that mixture I talk about, or the use of social media, because many of these parties are brilliant at using social media better than established parties, or the way in which they aggregate quite diverse social groups, bringing them together with a very simplistic but emotionally appealing narrative about making country X great again, and all the problems are the fault of the bloody immigrants. So no, clearly there's an instrumentarium, there's a toolkit that they have in common. And
Is
I
there
don't think the established parties have been very good yet at working out how to respond to it.
a slight contradiction in the sense that commentators often say, maybe to explain some of the complacency amongst the establishment, quote unquote, is that these are essentially they are political parties. They've achieved a certain level of success at the national level in government once they if they join a government or form a government, but they remain essentially a protest movement, and once they get the reins of power, people will quickly find out that they're useless at actually governing. But does that belie actually what has ha happened in many countries across Europe?
I don't think that is borne out by the facts. I mean, I think it varies from case to case. But what I think is clearly demonstrable, and indeed has been demonstrated by my Oxford colleague, the political scientist Tariq Abu Chadi, is that what a lot of centre-right policies are doing, a kind of accommodationism, where you try and steal the populist clothes. You know, you adopt some of their rhetoric, adopt some of their politics, generally doesn't work, right? Because people quite understandably say, you know, why should I have the dog whistle when I could have the real dog?
But there's a you mentioned just now Viktor Orban, but you think like for mainstream parties, there is a to use a slightly maybe non-political word, a kind of natural lifespan, almost preordained lifespan for these hard right parties as well, once they're in government. I mean, that they will get turfed out by voters at some point as mainstream parties are.
Well, let's step back a moment because that's assuming they come into government. And of course, you know, we have this strange mixture in relation to a party like the AfD in Germany, where on the one hand, you're seeing that accommodationism. You're seeing the Christian Democrats move towards some of those positions, for example, on immigration. But on the other hand, you still have this cordon sanitaire between the democratic parties and, be it AfD in Germany or Rassemblement National in France. So the prior question is, do you at all costs try to keep them out of government, or do you take the risk of having them in government, hoping that it will, on the one hand, so to speak, moderate and, dare one even say, civilize them, but on the other hand, you know, then people get fed up with them. So that seems to be a prior question, but I think it would be extremely complacent to think that they're evanescent, short-lived phenomena. I mean, after all, the Front National, now Rassemblement National, has been a factor in French politics for decades now. And look, peace, law and justice in Poland suffered this great defeat last October, but my goodness, it's still a major force in Polish politics. It looks very like an enduring feature of Polish politics.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I am trying to look for some kind of bright spots in this discussion. So, Tusk regained the premiership in Poland last year, as you say. Okay, his opposition party just said it's very strong, but the civic platform now is the governing party in Poland. You have what seems to be a quite a strong growing opposition to Fidesz and Viktor Orban in Hungary. No, there are signs of some kind of redressment.
Look, no regime lasts forever,
Right.
right? I mean, Viktor Orban has been there for 14 years.
Yeah.
And it has to be said, I mean, I've said this before, but I want to say it again. It is for me still a shocking fact that we have a full member state of the EU, now holding the presidency of the Union, tomorrow hosting an informal summit of EU leaders, which is no longer a democracy. I mean, most political scientists would say competitive authoritarian, not democracy. So that's a shocking fact. But even competitive authoritarian systems, at some point, sooner or later, rulers will be toppled, as Slobodan Milosevic was in Serbia, by the way, in consequence of an election. Okay, but I don't think one and a half swallows make a spring.
Right. If you could take a brief detour to the European Parliament, I want to ask you this because it's where all these groups across member states are contained in the under one roof, as it were. And as we know, the far right, hard right, did very well in the June elections this year. But when it came to creating political groups, they couldn't agree on one single group. Maybe that was naive in the first place. But we have, for the benefit of our listeners, to remind them, we have three groups on that edge of the political spectrum: European Conservatives and Reformists, the Patriots for Europe group, and the Europe of Sovereign Nations, each with strong national leaders, Meloni and Poland in one group, France, Hungary, and Italy, the Lega in the second group, and of course the AfD in the third group. They couldn't agree to be under one leadership. Does that suggest that ultimately they're not going to be less effective in the European Parliament, at least because they just could not agree to come together?
Well, a couple of points on that. I mean, one is we said already nationalist, international,
Yeah.
some contradiction, surely. So that is something intrinsic, I think, as opposed to, say, green parties, which would more laterally seek transnational allies. Point number two, of course, one key to those divisions is the fact that we have the largest war in Europe since 1945 continuing to rage in Ukraine, and these parties differ greatly on their attitude to Vladimir Putin's Russia. Now, at some point down the road, that's a factor, a divisive factor that's going to disappear. The third point I would make is that, I think seen from Brussels, there's always a danger of, dare I say, a little complacency, or at least of being too reassured by the fact that in the European institutions and in the European Parliament, the centre has held. That's clearly the case. But it's not the case in the national politics. And as we know, when push comes to shove on the big issues, it's the national governments and therefore the national politics that count. So I think in that sense, what's happened in the European institutions and the Parliament in particular, one shouldn't be too reassured by it.
Okay, let's go broaden our horizon then briefly before we finish this chat, Timothy, and look to the United States. Of course, 2 days ago, the elections, a result a lot of people did not expect, to say the least. There's been a certain amount of commentary in the 48 hours since then to the effect that a lot of these hard right groups, you would call them now, may feel emboldened by Trump's victory. Do you subscribe to that thesis?
Absolutely. I mean, it is just so self-evident that what Europe should do in response is to unite, to get our act together, to do more for our own defense, to have a more coherent foreign policy, something I've been, trying to work towards for years and years, particularly with the European Council on Foreign Relations. But I fear that the reality will be other. Firstly, because there is the party of Trump in Europe, Orban, Fico, Meloni, I think, Kaczynski, Farage, Geert Wilders. We can go on and on. All those parties we talked about. Secondly, because an awful lot of European countries, including, of course, many East European countries and Britain, will seek to keep some sort of a special relationship with the United States. right? I mean, I'm very worried about what's going to happen with Britain because, as you know very well, we have a government that's doing the splits between Europe and, as it were, the Anglosphere and the rest of the world. But if Trump is slapping massive tariffs on the EU specifically, given Britain's enormous economic difficulties post-Brexit and post-austerity, I think there'll be a big temptation to try and cut a special deal with Trump. And so, in short, I fear divisions are more likely to emerge than the unity that should.
Well, it's unity that should. The trite phrase, a wake-up call has been done to death in the past 48 hours.
Well, as someone said, you can wake up but not necessarily get out of bed.
I like that. But nonetheless, there is this need for Europe to get its act together, as you're suggesting, where a lot of Europeans like to say Europe is progress in Europe is always forged through crisis. Absent a crisis, we remain in our complacent little situation, which is true. But do you see any grounds for optimism that this particular wake-up call, on the basis that leaders get out of bed, will lead to something more constructive and more positive because the stakes are so high?
Honestly, if we don't wake up and get out of bed, faced with Putin on one side, Trump on the other, and so to speak, an increasingly post-Western world on the third, right? I mean, that's a world in which other non-Western powers like India and Russia, self-evidently, China, Brazil, South Africa play a larger and larger role. If you put together those three enormous challenges, if we don't wake up now, when will we? So I very much hope so, and I think that's clearly what we should do. But it is deeply distressing that in this situation you have a Britain that has Brexited, a Germany which chooses the day after Trump's election, of all days, its government to collapse in rancor, leading to the prospect of months of uncertainty and limbo. And France, of course, with a really weak and unstable government there on sufferance from Marine Le Pen, it doesn't look great, does it?
You see any scope there? This sounds like wishful thinking, I suppose, that at least on the security side, that the UK and the EU will just have to be much more creative and much more open-minded about serious collaboration beyond the talk and all the nice handshakes and
So,
smiles.
absolutely. And it's very interesting that the probable next Chancellor of Germany, the Christian Democrat Friedrich Merz, speaking immediately after Trump's election, said, we've got to get our act together. And the key to that is four powers: Germany, France, Poland, and Britain.
Right.
So he includes, curiously enough, not, he didn't mention Italy, didn't mention Spain in that, but Germany, France, Poland, and Britain. And that's clearly the case when you look at military, diplomatic, intelligence, and defense industry. The rubber will hit the road when it comes to defense procurement. And the question will be if Britain is prepared really to seek seriously this strategic partnership with the EU as such, and I think the Starmer government is prepared to do that in a moment of such peril for us all in Europe. Are our European friends and partners prepared to say, okay, well, it can't be that when it comes to all the money, the goodies to being generated for defense procurement, all that goes only intra-EU? If our major European partners are prepared to take that step, and that of course involves particularly France, then I think you have a strategic deal.
Right, a final question then, Timothy. Quite understandably, you've painted a pretty dark picture, gloomy picture in the past 20 minutes or so. Are there any grounds for optimism in the coming period that you can identify to give us some kind of reassurance that there's some light at the end of the tunnel?
Yes, two. Number one, in Poland last year, you had an unfree election. It was not a level playing field. But because there was an unprecedented level of turnout, more women voted than men, more young people voted than old people, unheard of. They, to use the traditional British phrase, kicked the bastards out. And so in our domestic politics, that seems to be a very positive example for others. in terms of our broader European politics and Europe in the world, I do think that there is an almost universal acknowledgement intellectually and in our sort of strategic debate that we need to get our act together and do more to defend our values and interests in the world. And that's progress already. And so the challenge is now to translate that into political action.
Right. Well, we more or less arrived at a relatively optimistic point, but we have to leave it there. Timothy Garton-Ash, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure as always.